My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink since April 22nd, 1985. And I want to thank Perry and Eric for asking me to come and talk. I love this conference. I'm treated very kindly and very generously, and I really appreciate it. There's a bunch of people I haven't seen in a long time, friends of mine who I really haven't, some of whom I haven't seen in a couple of years, and some new friends, and it's just been great. I've been away from home for about 11, 12 days. I was just in New York and pulled in yesterday and had a chance to visit with one of my dearest friends last night, and it's just been great. If you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for me. That I'm having a good time. My friend Charlie and I have been collecting different ways that people identify at AA meetings for years. When we get a real good one, we call each other. Some years ago, he called me. He had heard a guy identify as a crack monster. And I haven't had a chance to tell him this, but a guy raised the bar. We have a place in L.A. called the Marina Center, which is a great AA hall. It's a real Alcoholics Anonymous hall. There's wet drunks. occasional fight will break out during a meeting, which I always makes me more comfortable, kind of. And people were raising their hands, with less than 30 days. My name's Carmen. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic. And this guy got up and said, "My name's Tom. Big problem. Big problem." And then he said, and then he sat down, and I could have gone home right then. Right then, I could have gone home. It was the whole story, absolutely the whole story. And that was my identification when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come here and say, "I'm an alcoholic." I didn't catch alcoholism for a while in AA. I mean, I didn't get a diagnosis. I didn't even know what alcoholism was, you know. But I had a big problem. It was a big problem. So there it is, Charlie. It's a new one for us, and it's a great one. My wife and I have started a nursery school. My wife Nancy's been involved in progressive nursery school education for many years, since we had a spiritual experience and wound up in the program. And we live in the on the grounds where the nursery school is that we started, and we were going to build a structure. We didn't get to build it, so there's been rough weather in L.A., so we took all our personal possessions, or a good amount of them, and moved them into a basement area so that we could sort of have the school in the house until the weather breaks. And 2 days ago, that entire space filled with water and destroyed everything. And I want to tell you, it's absolutely uncanny to me. It's just an annoyance. It really is. It's just an annoyance. Now, when I get home later this afternoon, I might drop to my knees, start screaming, gnashing my teeth, and rending my clothing. I know that's within the realm of possibility. But the story I'm going to tell you this morning is the fact, and I'm going to tell my story this morning, is that my life is no longer my circumstances. It's just not. And my life was all circumstances before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A woman recently called me. She had heard some CDs that I had recorded. She called me a couple of weeks ago from Eskimo land, and she wanted to know if my life was still good. And I thought about it for a second. And the fact is the circumstances of my life are not as good, not even close to as conventionally good as they were when I recorded those CDs. But I was able to honestly say to her, yes, my life is. Which again, I'm sure if you're new, thrills the crap out of you. Because I know I was so thrilled for people who were having a good time when I got there. I was overjoyed for them. And I would often hear people talk about the new house and the new car and the new wife and stuff. And I'd sit in my seat and I'd think, you know, maybe you'll go home later and your house will burst into flame, you know. And we'll see how spiritual you are next week. So if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a drug addict, welcome to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to welcome all the tweakers. If there are any tweakers here today, I'd like to welcome you. There you go. Do you remember why you just raised your hand? You don't. But I like you guys. You stay quick for a while, and every part of your face is moving in a different direction. If you've ever masturbated till you're dehydrated, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really glad you're here. I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming pretty close. But I'm really not making fun of you. I don't care what you've got. I don't care if you're like the Bigfoot of dope addicts, a dope Goliath, a dope juggernaut, or a crack monster. I don't care. Just catch alcoholism. Catch alcohol. We'd love to give it to you. I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And my sponsor used to say that the infection enters through the ear and starts infecting you, and you actually start infecting other people. And I was not alcoholic when I came to AA, for a bunch of reasons. I'm Jewish. And Jews don't drink, you know, because it might dull the pain. You certainly don't want to squander any agony opportunity. In addition to the Judaism, I could not have possibly been alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to AA. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. I'm in therapy now. I've got no beef with therapy at all. My colossal blunder is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife. It's just a horrible idea. If you're neurotic, if you've ever been, I don't know if anybody here has been told they're neurotic. A neurosis is if you have anxiety, right? You have anxiety, and then you resolve the anxiety in an unsatisfying way. I don't know if that resonates for anyone here, but it means your solutions are worse than your problems. So you go to therapy, conventional therapy, to free associate, to uncover, discover, unravel, delve into your past, and come up with a better resolution for your anxiety. But I've got alcoholism. So I'm going to therapy, and I said, I feel terrible. Why? Well, I was so drunk yesterday. I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? Let's talk about it. I got it. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. Nothing. Treat nothing. My alcoholism produces anxiety and insanity at such a horrific rate, you would need a panel of therapists working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to file my stuff, just to get it into a folder and get it up on a shelf, let alone resolve anything. So I came to AA absolutely a non-alcoholic, and I came to AA an agnostic. You know, an agnostic tells us basically that you can't prove the existence of God. And an atheist says that I have proof that there is no God. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous an atheist, an atheist is a difficult thing to be. It takes a certain kind of commitment to moral bankruptcy and a certain kind of self-imposed ignorance that requires a lot of work, a lot of energy. To really stay in that position is not an easy thing to do. You know, your knuckles are white all the time. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City to a completely insane family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it. So the bun was bouncing off her forehead all night. If you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. My uncle was a welder, and he used to get free bales of steel wool. Like, here's your paycheck and your complimentary bale of steel wool. And his wife took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the free steel wool. And that stuff works its way through on you after a while. So when you were at their house, if you looked at the room, everybody was moving a little bit. You know, the whole room was like a pulsing, living, breathing organism. And I'm telling you the cute stuff. It was bad. I had relatives that wound up in the back wards of Grasslands Mental Institution. That's a horrible state institution in New York. We had chronic institutionalization, suicide attempts, mental and physical abuse. And if you're new, all I've got is good news, because my family didn't have one thing to do with making me an alcoholic. And I'm not telling you they didn't injure me. They injured me terribly. And I'm not telling you that I haven't had to do a lot of stuff about that. I have, you know. But that didn't make me an alcoholic. I cannot control or moderate once I begin drinking. I can't. And if you're a special and a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking, you know. Just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in the mood, and blow it out, and hats will fill the air, I guarantee it. I have an allergy. It only happens in a certain class of people. Pretty, you know, one out of 10. And I have this bizarre mental twist, this wacky thinking that says to me, you don't have that allergy. You don't. You don't have the allergy. You're okay. Go with God. You're fine. And I still have this thinking. And this thinking kept driving me to take a drink I couldn't stop taking, and I developed this cancer of the soul, this spiritual tapeworm that ate me up from the inside and left me hollow and insane and alone. And when my kids or my wife or my dreams got in between me and the drink, they either vanished or they became paper mache. They became something less than human. And that's a baffling way to live. And no relative can make that person. And I still have this thinking. I still have this thinking, which is why I do more in AA than I ever have before. 19 and a half years in, I do more. I hang out with guys and gals who do more. When things get good, they do more. When things get bad, they do more. They do more. Those are the people I've been hanging out with since I got sober. And I was about 14 years sober. I had to get an operation on my hand. And this doctor said to me, Mr. Redmond, you're going to need general anesthetic with this operation. And I said, general anesthetic? That's great. Normal people don't get excited about general anesthetic. There's no normal person that gets giddy over general anesthetic. But I do, because I know something about general anesthetic. I know that when they hit you with it, they say count backwards from 100. And you go 199. I love 99. You know? I love 99. a couple of years later, I was about 16 years sober, and I had a different doctor, and he said, you know, that operation you had on your hand, you're going to need it on your other hand. And I looked at this doctor and said, I guess we'll be having some of that general anesthetic. And he looks at me and goes, you don't need general anesthetic with this. And my first thought was, no, I need another goddamn doctor is what I need. Like now. I still have the thinking. I grew up in this crazy family. I started going to therapy at about 14, dropped out of school, stayed out of school for 3.5 years on the streets of New York City. Didn't get understood a lot. Had a lot of serious, really serious mental problems. Became school phobic, worked in a hardware store at 14, put myself through acting school. I've met very few lazy alcoholics. Even the ones that aren't doing much aren't lazy. I find us to be very industrious, if nothing else. When I was about 21 years old, I was I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I really did not. I tried to get into a gang. I failed. And I went, the hippies had a recruiting station across the street. I went over, there was no test over there, believe me. And I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here. You remember WOW, right? WOW. WOW. And right after WOW usually came, what? What? WOW, what, WOW, what, WOW. Wow, what, wow. Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. By the way, I'm going to talk about drugs. I don't mean to offend anybody, I swear. And if I do, please tell Eric. Because I didn't call him and ask him if I could come a couple of thousand miles to piss people off. I really, don't say that sarcastically, I really don't mean to offend anybody here. It's my story. And it's one of the reasons I came to Alcoholics Anonymous without alcoholism. And I almost died from it. I overcame my marijuana problem with pills. I conquered my pill problem with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex, if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. I kicked that gall darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. Then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. And I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And I was 21 years old. I shot some dope and got on the West Side Highway to hitchhike from the Bronx down to Manhattan. And my aunt and uncle picked me up on the freeway. My father had had a massive stroke. And I was taken to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for my old man the night he died. I couldn't even go in and touch my dad on the cheek and give him a kiss and watch him take his light into another room. I was a pig, an animal. I had holes in my arms. The curtain was down. I couldn't even hear the beep of the heart machine. And I had already so rearranged my life to accommodate alcoholism. The ice around my heart was already so thick. My father was dead and he was going to rot, and that was it. Game over. Side out. I had nothing else. I had no idea about the connective tissue that I was experiencing, you know. And I had to do some quick work. The agony I was in, I couldn't be the guy who couldn't show up for his dad. And I did some pretty quick work, and I realized there was needles and heroin, and all I had to do was never put a needle in my arm again, and I wouldn't be the guy who couldn't show up for his father. And I didn't. Not for 13 years. And shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play, and a new usherette walked in with long brown hair. And I took one look at her. I didn't even say hello to her. I walked back into the dressing room of this show, and I stood up on a chair and I announced that if anybody talked to the new usherette with long brown hair, I'd break all the bones in their hands and feet. And we celebrated 28 years of marriage last June. In part because we've never wanted to get divorced at the same time. So if you've been married for a while, you're clapping right now, probably. There's some timing involved in this. There really is some timing involved in this. And we had a great time. You know, if you're new, you're going to hear some wacky stuff about alcoholism. I've been hearing this stuff for years. And some of it makes sense to me and some of it doesn't. The stuff that doesn't make sense to me, I've yet to find in the big book of AA. You know, I've heard that alcoholics don't like change of any kind. I don't like change that I don't like. But I really love change that I like. I've never heard anybody get to a podium and say, geez, I hit the lottery, I'm having sex with identical twins, it's killing me, the change is just putting me through the ringer. I just don't like change. I've heard that alcoholics are perfectionists. I'm a pig. I am not a perfectionist. The only time that I have an explosion of perfectionism is when my wife is caring for me. That seems to be when I get very, very perfectionistic. But about myself, we're fine. We're fine. My personal favorite is that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have never heard it at an Al-Anon meeting, ever. Oh, those wily... I mean, you heard the personal humiliations last night? Yeah. But this is really the Rand Corporation. More like the Darwin Awards. And one of the nutty things that just... I know it makes sense to some people. I think it's a misquote of a sentence from the end of the third chapter. I've heard people say, my worst day in here is better than my best day out there. No. No. I had a great time out there. Let's see. Pound of cocaine in an all-female jazz band or a panel at the prison. I don't know. What do you want to do? what the guy says at the end of chapter 3 is, I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day out there, because I won't trade this way of life. I won't do it. I won't fall victim to the strange mental twist. I won't settle for a nickel today when I could have a quarter tomorrow. I won't live like a sap anymore. What? That speaks to so much. I mean, my alcoholism went below the horizon. It stopped presenting itself as a real piece of business, and I drank over and over again, no matter what. There were things that would happen in my life, and our book echoes this gorgeously, that would keep it above the horizon for a period of time. I'd fall in love, fall out of love, something great would happen, something terrible would happen, and would buoy my alcoholism and keep it as a real and present danger, a real piece of business. And I wouldn't drink for a period of time. But that's on my own steam. And eventually it would sink below the horizon, and I would act without explanation, without reason. I would be watching this terrible movie of myself do these things. What could possibly... Therapy couldn't keep it above the horizon. The love of a wife and children. A wonderful... Nothing ever kept it as a real piece of business. And yet it's been a real piece of business for me for 19 and a half years. Nancy and I had a great time. We're living in New York. We're in our early 20s. I was acting on Broadway. We had a beautiful baby boy who was really welcomed into the world, our son Micah. 2 years and 9 months later, we had our second baby, and no one even came to the hospital to see us. It hurt too much to be around us. We were completely isolated by alcoholism in just 2 years and 9 months. I didn't know that. I didn't know what was wrong. I thought these people were just horrible. They just were fair weather friends and fair weather like family, like mothers and fathers-in-law and stuff. They all sucked, you know. Jesse was sick. He had transitive tachypnea of the heart. He wound up in an incubator, and this doctor called me that night from the hospital and said, "Mr. Redmond, your wife's in extreme psychological duress. There's nobody here. There hasn't even been a call. Where are you? Your baby's in an incubator." And I said, "You know what? I can't find anyone to watch my two-year-old son." And she said to me something pretty remarkable. She said, "You know, I'll give you my husband's home. I'll give you my address and phone number." I said, "Doctor, I've never even met before. You can take your son to my house and my husband will watch him for you." And I said, no. I had no way to accept this woman's generosity. My son would have been better off if I had taken him to the hospital and left him in the waiting room with a coloring book. At least he could have got the hell away from me. And this is where we wound up. And as Bill says in his story, little were we to know that this was going to continue for 3 years. 3 years, and it got worse. We started at the bottom when Jesse was born, and we just spread out. Micah came to me at 5 years old and asked me if there was something such as God, and I looked into the eyes of my perfect 5-year-old son, and I said, no. I said, no. I told a 5-year-old baby, when you're scared and you're alone and you can't go to sleep, tough, because that's all there is. He should have been taken away from me. And Nancy and I got terribly ill. We got so sick that at one point a guy lent us a car and we sold his car. And Ed Mutum actually lent me his watch this morning, which is... because Ed is a trusting man and he hadn't heard my story yet. I'll never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car?" That's like house sitting for someone, and they come home and you're an escrow, you know. I'll tell you, well, this is what, 2 months before I got sober, this was a good morning in the Redmond home. Remember, we started on Broadway. This is where we wound up. I had an accident. They took me to the hospital. My blood pressure was 180 over 110. They said, you're going to stroke out. You got to lose weight. I said, look, and we're going to medicate you. I said, look, I would like to lose weight, but I drink alcohol and I smoke marijuana before I go to bed every night, so I'm not going to be able to. And the doctor said to me, "Why don't we prescribe some medication for you?" And I said, "What a country." And he prescribed chloral hydrate for me, which is a knockout drop. It's a Mickey. It's like getting hit in the head with a sap. And I love these pills. I love them. So Nan comes home, and I'm standing in the hallway eating handfuls of knockout drops and slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drop, because you don't want to waste a perfectly good knockout drop. And I keep eating these pills and slamming body parts into the wall until I just seize. I keel over, and I go upstairs, and now I'm incontinent like the rest of the 33-year-old men in America. And this is a good morning in the Redmond home. I got up one night and wet the wall. And my wife was, like, excited the next morning. He wet the wall. He's headed towards the bathroom, you know. It's progress, not perfection. This is great. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on April 22nd, 1985, my sons were 6 and 3. They were in terrible condition. Their small motor skills were screwed up. There was nothing organically wrong with them. They were so disrupted from being frightened all the time, they couldn't put small tasks together. They couldn't stop clicking their throats, grinding their teeth. They were reading years below their grade level, and they tested in excess of 150 IQ. They were... I hadn't read about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. I had no idea of the lists written about the thinking that gets hardwired into alcoholic homes. I didn't know that my sons had become either pointlessly aggressive en route to a goal that never got reached, or just threw in the towel and said, "What's the use anyway? What's the use anyway?" And you know, when a kid gets in between you and the drink and keeps vanishing, how much can the baby bear until the baby just buys it? And they float away. They float away. They hide in a corner. They stay in the shadows, or they scream and yell so you can see them, but you can't see them too good because your vision's so blurry. And this was the sickness that was killing us. We were dying. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again, ever. I swore I would never put a needle in my arm. I just drank and took prescribed medication. I put a needle in my arm again, and I called my therapist of record in my 18th year of psychotherapy, my first Jungian therapist. And my first Jungian therapist said to me the exact same, well, almost the exact same thing that Carl Jung told the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. He said, "You know what? I can't help you. There's absolutely nothing I can do for you." I said, "What?" He said, "We need to institutionalize you." And then he said the thing that Carl Jung couldn't say to Roland Hazard. He said, "Or you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous." Why I went to that AA meeting, I have no idea. On any other day, I would have gladly chosen the institution. I'm a guy who got excited when I was told I needed dental surgery, you know, when I needed general anesthetic. I mean, that's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. Why I went to the AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. But I did. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I got my best clothes on, and I went to a clubhouse called Unit A in the deep San Fernando Valley. And I walked, I had a bad check to write you. That's how much I knew about AA. And I walked into this room and I looked around and I said, "Oh my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. How?" And the room looked like it was the product of 200 years of inbreeding to me. I mean, there were like, I thought there were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room. It was just unbelievable. And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. The coffee and furniture are miracles. It's a miracle. Miracle. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to start, right? I know that's going to break out. "Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on." Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. "Come on, we'll knock his beanie off, and when he bends down to pick it over, we'll push him over. It'll be fun." I hated. And then the AA unsolicited advice guy, he saw me at the end of the meeting. You know him, right? Right? He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Do I want what you've got? No. No. No, but thanks for spitting on me, Clyde. I really appreciate it. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. And I think I know why. I was out of plans. I was just out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you have a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan, which I'm convinced is going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually, is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. Many of us have seen this. We're not lazy. And I guess I was out of plans. And here's the other deal. It was a mystery to me. A complete mystery to me. Why I went to the AA meeting instead of the Nutter House is a mystery to me. Why I came back is a mystery to me. St. Thomas says to know God is to not know God. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that no one can fully comprehend or define that power which is God. It's a mystery to me. A mystery that used to drive me mad, and it's a mystery I crave now. I crave it. I don't have a God who flooded my house. I don't. I don't have a God who says, let's key your car. You're due for a rash. It's boils for you. I can't. And Charlie and I know each other pretty good, you know. And when I told him about the flood, he went, well, God. And then I just went. I kept coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups, and one of the reasons I love this conference is because I love being around Al-Anon and the Al-Anon family groups, and I love the robust Al-Anon participation here. And my wife got this wonderful sponsor named Ruby, who is still her sponsor today, and started getting her deal, and I would go over to that house and feel radioactive. That house was just like a love bomb. You know, 50 to 100 people hanging out, just loving each other, and I just would look around and I'd say that newcomer thing. I'm so glad for you. I'm so glad for you, which, you know, usually means please get away from me. / it'll never happen for me. And we had insane rules in our house. Our sons were not allowed to curse, watch TV, or eat sugar. So Nancy would take the boys to Ruby's house. She'd give them a big bowl of M&Ms, turn on the Love Boat, and Milton, her husband, I'm going to use one bad word, please forgive me, and would call them over one day when they were little boys, and he bent down. He had 20 years at the time, and he whispered to them, boys, your parents don't know shit. And my kids went, oh, my God, we suspected, but now it's been confirmed. This is fantastic. And the boys just, they lightened us up. They pried our jaws open and just spit life into us. Our kids love Ruby. They love Milton. Ruby's been giving them $5 for their birthday since they were tiny little boys, you know. And again, we had these insane rules. My wife would give my sons healthy granola for breakfast and put them in the car with me, Dr. Death, you know. And said, hope you live. You've had a macrobiotic breakfast and you're ready to die, you know. But you can't control the thing, right? So you dress it up. You put lipstick on that pig, you know. I stuck around AA for 6 months and enjoying the gift of step none. And I knew I was going to drink. I had seen the drill hundreds of times in a scant 6 months that I was here. People came in and did the work and changed. People came in, didn't do the work, didn't change, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium and shared their gift with us, or shared themselves right out the door, or stayed here and became columns of human sewage and sexual predators, although I judge no men, because I'm too spiritually developed. And I knew I was going to drink. And my wife, I saw the deal in my wife. She says she saw it in me. I saw it in her. And I'd seen this guy at my group, and he was a happy guy, and he wasn't afraid to be an AA goody-goody because he got to the podium, and I never heard this guy say, I don't know how this thing works. He got to the podium, and he said, this is what I'm doing. And he talked about the inventory process, using it for change and using it to be of service. And he was just one of those guys. And I asked him to sponsor me. He made sure that I had done some reading from the Big Book of AA. He invited me to his house. And he read chapter 5 to me, and on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3, got on our knees and said a prayer, which I felt was annoying and unnecessary and embarrassing, but I did it anyway. And then he finished chapter 5, and he went back and he gave me instructions on how to do an inventory from the Big Book of AA. And it took me 3 months to write my inventory. I read it to him when I was 9 months sober. I consider myself lucky that I stayed sober long enough to do the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I read it to him, and I did step 6 and 7 for the first time, which have really become the centerpiece of my relationship with my higher power. And then it came time to write up my 8-step list. I try to share this anytime I talk because it's the best reading of step 8 I've ever heard. And I heard it when I was a couple of weeks sober at my first home group, the North Hollywood Men's Stag. It was from a guy named Nino. Never seen him before, never seen him since. He had never read chapter 5 before. He had a heavy New York accent. He was there with a hospital group. He had hospital plastic on. And he was reading chapter 5, and he got up to step 8, and he read, made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen this? He literally looked up. He went, do you know what's in here? It's all I saw on the list. I didn't see any of the other steps. I mean, I just looked. I went, no, not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back. No way. What do you think? I'm an idiot. If you're new, don't worry about it. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway, for God's sake. And 8's not even really the annoying one. It's 9. 9's really the annoying one. At any rate, I wrote up my 8-step list, and my wife and my kids and my dad had to go down there, and anybody I'd worked for, I was a terrible thief. And I mean that literally. I was a bad thief. I got caught all the time. And I didn't know how I was going to make amends to my wife or my kids or my dad. I know how to make amends to my employers. You pay the money back. It's really not very complicated at all. And I was blessed with a sponsor who refused to tell me how to make amends. He said, I don't know what you got to do to get your dad back in your life. I don't know. Do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's go. Let's get busy. Let's do the deal. Let's do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Address your inventory as your spiritual task. And now let's do your job. And that's what I did. And I hung out with these guys. I followed them around. In my area at that time, there were a lot of old-timers. There were some who had a lot of time. Some old-timers who were still doing inventory and working with newcomers. And some old-timers who were just pissed off. Pissed off. And there was this sort of prevailing wisdom that they were okay because they had a lot of time. And it took me a while before I realized that it wasn't okay. They were just mean, you know, and this alleged wisdom they had, it never surfaced for me. You know, it was, shut up, you're an idiot. I'm not interested. If your lips are moving, you're lying. Well, I got to talk to somebody. I mean, I certainly don't have to get to the podium and do that stuff, but it was very, very helpful to me to see the people with 20, 30, and 40 years who were still using the inventory as a tool for change, who were still driving. My sponsor died at 33 years sober. And the newcomers that he was driving to meetings were there at his memorial. You know? There were people in my area who said, well, time's no big deal. And one old-timer I used to love to say, if it doesn't mean anything, go get some. And I liked that a lot. And I went and got some. And I gravitated to those people who were involved in the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is love and service. For me. That's what it is for me. And you told Nancy and I not to get involved in our first year, and we didn't. We stayed the hell away from each other. I had nothing to bring to my marriage. Absolutely nothing. I didn't know how to fight with my wife. I didn't know how to talk to her. I was a filthy fighter. I would either yell at her until she shut up, or I would cry until she shut up. Either one's fine. I've always loved the tyranny of helplessness. It's always been a real big color on my palette. And I would loom. I'm a big guy. I like to loom. I like to loom with a light behind me, get her in a shadow. It's like total eclipse of the Jew if I get her like right in there, right? Right? And if I can work a scream, a cry, and a loom into one fight, that's a hat trick. It doesn't get a whole lot better than that. That's communication. I'm going to give you the Scott Redmond Couples Workshop right now. It's going to take 11 seconds. Talk to her until she changes her mind. Just talk to her until her eyes roll back in her head and she keels over, and on the way down she goes, oh, okay. One of the most troublesome defects of character for me, drunk and sober, has been the defect of mind reading. I think that I know what people are thinking sometimes. By the way, they're never thinking anything good. They're usually thinking, you're a hosebag, or that's mine, or they're never, it's very rarely are they thinking something splendid. My wife once said to me, you're not a mind reader, you're barely a mind user. And I started doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to show up at my kid's school and sit down with his teachers and say, you know what, my kid's been a gifted underachiever, and he's been a problem because he's very ill, because he's been living with me, and I've been very sick, and can you help us? Horrible thing to have to do. Terrifying, embarrassing. No one ever said no. Anyone I ever went to and told the truth about my kids to said, oh yeah, absolutely. You know, we've got all sorts of resources. Let's test the boys and see what we can do. The boys got tested and they got special ed. The special ed teacher said, let's get them into big motor stuff. We'll see if that shakes down to the small motor stuff. Let's get them into music. Let's get them into sports. I hadn't gotten it together to buy my kid a mitt and register him in the Little League. Maybe I said I would. Maybe I did one time. But I started doing it because I was doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. They got into music. Jesse wanted to play the drums, so I didn't have any dough. I went to the store and I bought him a drum pad, which is a piece of wood, a piece of rubber, and two sticks. But my kid wanted something, and I backed him up. That's huge. And I went to my home group, and you'll understand it if you have a home group like mine, and I told the guys, because they wanted to know, because they were rooting for our family, because they had a vested interest in us, because they saw this ember they were blowing on, you know? And they were proud of me, you know? And within 2 months, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were like a lot of burnout drummers in my group at that time. Guys are showing up with these mega death drums. Dude. Jesse had this huge drum set that he literally, you couldn't see him when he sat behind it. This little tiny voice behind this huge drum set. And a couple of years ago, my kids played the House of Blues in L.A. on the Sunset Strip, and they burnt the dump down. Burnt it down. Playing hip-hop music to this packed room, 800-900 kids, elbow to elbow, these two poised, gorgeous men, 23 and 26 now. And over to the side is this group of weeping, middle-aged alcoholics, you know. Kids are going, what is with the crying old people? What is that all about? They look like they've been around the block, too. Aerosmith roadies or something like that. And that's their AA and Al-Anon aunts and uncles that have been following them around for 19 years. My son, when I was a couple of years sober, and I was making lunch for my kids, and I said to Micah, my oldest son, who was, I think, 8 at the time, I said, what do you want in your hot dog? He said, I want mustard, onions, and lettuce. And I went, lettuce? He said, no, okay, no lettuce. And he walked away, and he came back to me about 45 minutes later. He looked at me directly in the eye, and I'm not altering one syllable. He said to me, I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for. So I asked him to sponsor me at that point. What's that? What the hell is that? What is that? A couple of years after this, Micah was about 10, Jesse was about 7, and Jesse got into a schoolyard accident. He broke his wrist in a growth plane, which is, if you know about kids, it's a piece of cartilage that's going to develop in a bone. When it gets injured, you cannot disrupt it. It's really important. Now, he's a younger brother, and he's come home with a cast, with a weapon. All of a sudden, the playing field is very level. He's looking forward to keeping this cast on for the rest of his life, okay? So they're just beating the crap out of each other, you know, 10 minutes after I get them home. And it's not something I can repeat 11 times. They can't do it. It's too dangerous. So I get right up in Micah's face and I yell at him because he's the older brother. You can't do this. He walks away from me. He walks into his room and he slams the door. Slam the door. So I got the dad tick going now. I go to the door and I open the door, and before I can unload on him, he looks up at me. He's 10 now. He says, "Hold it a second. I didn't say you were wrong out there. You were right. But a huge guy just got in my face and screamed at me. I didn't tell you you were wrong. Don't tell me I can't be mad." What the hell is that? What's that? What do you do? Well, okay. Right? Whatever. That's something he's been watching his mother and I try to do with varying degrees of success and failure in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. We can retaliate, we can repress, or we can stop playing God and tell people how we feel without telling them what to do. And that's exactly what he did. A beautiful spiritual demonstration. And I started being able to participate in my marriage. I didn't know that you cleaned a house. I didn't know this. I thought somewhere in the back of my sick mind that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products, of housework to sex. I had no idea that like a grown man like makes his bed. Completely outside of me. But the result of that is I'm standing next to guys 10 years younger than me my whole life and wondering what's it like to be grown up. You know. My sons have had a lot of adventures. They've had drug experiences. They've had overdoses. They've been thrown out of school. They apparently aren't allergic. And my son got thrown out of a very privileged school and sent to Starsky and Hutch High. I pulled up to check him in, and there was gangs being frisked on the front lawn. It was unbelievable. And we sit down and with this dean, and my kid is the kind of kid that these deans don't want. And the dean looks at me and says, "What do you think of your son?" And I said, "I think my son is a really smart, good man with a great heart, who is dealing with a situation that very poorly, and it's crushing him, and he's really scared and sad about it." And he said to Micah, "What do you think of this?" And Micah said, "I don't know. I'm just really glad my father's here with me." And the guy looked at us like, "Where is your flying saucer? You know, what is this all about?" And you know what? My son graduated high school. He went to Chiapas, Mexico, and worked with the Zapatista revolutionaries. He came back to the United States, became a rock and roll star, played huge halls with 40,000 people in them, and was politically offended by it, and he's now a union organizer. I mean, I have these incredible men in my life. They happen to be my sons, you know, and that doesn't mean that God loves us more than the people whose kids are being annihilated. I can't live in that world. I can't. Some years ago, we got nailed in the Northridge earthquake. Really bad. We were in the epicenter of it. A guy died near us. Our house got smashed. I had a bad physical injury. And shortly after the earthquake, we were in Canada at this AA function, and a woman who used to live in L.A. came up to me at the function and said, "Oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake." And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you, but we're crap, but he likes you. And she said to me, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. I'm out of here. I'm out of here. If I'm living with a God that's saying, get him, get the Redmond boy, get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him. Get him. Turn his wife to salt. Kill his goat. Put a finger in his eye. Get him. Smote his ass. Smote him. Smote anyone he talks to. Take him down now. I'm out of here. I'm out of here. Every time I ascribe an intention or a personality to God, I make him this big. The mystery is gigantic. The crazy idea that me and my friend Charlie could sit together having a cup of coffee last night and experience this connection, which I love. The idea that when he and I leave, that connection goes away, that's crazy. That's the connective tissue. That's the ember that I try to blow on and try to encourage in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the face and the breath of God. You know, years ago, my son was babysitting for this couple in the program, and the guy said, what do you think of your dad talking in AA? And Micah said, really, kind of nothing. I mean, I'm glad for him. I'm not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, all I can tell you is that since I'm a very, very little boy, the men and women of AA and Al-Anon have taken very good care of me, and never once has any of them demanded that I believe what they believe. Wow. Wow. That says an incredible amount for Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says an incredible amount for the people who I hang out with in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And particularly in this time of so much spiritual propriety, of watching spiritual tools being used as spiritual weapons, of this bullying, you know. Some years ago, in my first year of sobriety, I started sponsoring guys kind of near the end of my first year. And I was become sort of a spiritual Goliath at that time. And a writing job for 20th Century Fox. And I was being considered to direct the situation comedy. And I really thought that if I got this staff job directing the sitcom, which is a big job, big dough, that it would really, really help the men that I sponsor in a profound way. Because they, God, talk about seeing the program work. And I directed one episode, and I went, they had a picnic, and I went to the picnic, and I didn't go to the picnic to bring anything. I went there to get a job. The executive producer, I walked up to him. He had a beer. He said, would you like one of these? I said, sure. I went to the cooler, picked up a beer, and I don't know, the wind hit my face. I don't know what happened, but I said, you're dead. You're dead. You're dead, man. And I called my sponsor. I said, I almost drank. And he said to me, well, I guess you have, because I didn't get the job. I didn't get the job. And Don said to me, I guess you have the show business God. And I said, what? He said, well, what keeps you sober? I said, God keeps me sober. He said, okay, God keeps you sober. You didn't get a show business job and you almost drank, so I guess you have the show business God and he has abandoned you utterly. Now, when I came into AA, I heard about God getting people into relationships, God getting people jobs, God getting people parking spaces. And I said, oh, no, not the parking space, God. Not the parking space, God. What if you don't get a space? And if you have a parking space, God, and he gives you a space, pass it on. At any rate, I had to do an inventory. I had to write the resentment against myself for almost drinking and the company for not giving me the job. And when I did 6 and 7 that day, my sponsor said to me, when you draw closer to him, he'll reveal himself to you. This is this is the fire starting moment. You know, you're going to have to discuss with your higher power what you have to do to live in a world big enough so that you can lose a job and not drink. So that day when I did 6 and 7, I said, Pop, you got it. Take show business. I'm done. I'll do anything. Doesn't mean that I won't continue in show business, but it's not a deal breaker. I'll do anything you want for a living. Just keep me sober. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, I did not mean this. This wasn't even on the long list. I don't even know where this came from. And in L.A., when they shoot a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer, you follow the company around, you make food for them, and it's great dough. It's, you're on a vehicle on a movie set. It's Teamster dough. But I'm Scott Redman. And the first movie that I cater, the executive producer and star of the movie is a guy who I know from in the industry. I've worked with the guy. And he sticks his head on the truck that morning, and he says, "Can I have a burrito, Scott?" And I turn around, I said, "What's happening, babe?" And, and he said, "Is this your truck?" I said, "No, no, but it's my spatula." And I call my sponsor, and I said, "Oh, we're getting the gift now. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. This gift of sobriety is so beautiful." And he said to me, "Sounds like you've got a resentment." Resentment's no big deal. It's just this great destroyer of all alcoholics, the source of all spiritual illness. Because you see, I don't just hate stuff. I hate stuff so that when I wake up, I water the hatred and care for it like a little flower. I want to make sure it's tended to properly and it's developing. The worst thing is when I forget to hate something, you know? And a guy goes, "Hi." And I go, "Hi. Oh, I hate him. Why did I do that? No. Now I'm going to have to redouble my snubbing and glaring just to, like, get back to where we were, you know? I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. It eats my brain and my heart and turns my life black, and I die. I die, you know? So I had to go home, and I had to write this inventory. I was resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. And what are the defects in me that if God would remove the resentment would be gone? I'm ashamed. I'm impatient. I have fear of financial insecurity. I have false pride. I'm grandiose and I'm ungrateful. And I read it to my sponsor and I learn how to show up and give them a dime for their nickel and be a good cook. And my son Jesse, when he was a little boy, he didn't really that much care if I was writing and directing TV shows or movies. He wanted me to teach him how to cook. And he and I have been cooking together ever since. We just did it over the holidays. That's what he and I do together. He calls me up. He's in school and he's a physics major at Columbia University, you know, and he calls me up and says, "Talk me through that sauce." That's how he and I developed our intimacy. I would have chosen to be intimate with him by buffing my Oscars. That's the way I would have, really. It's Oscar polishing time, son. Let's have that time you and I love together. It's really about both of us. And I was able to help some guys. You know, there's some guys that come in AA who haven't reached the top rung of the ladder in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is Child of God. And they feel that they've fallen from a height. And I got to help some people who felt they had fallen from a height in AA. And I had this one friend named Paul who used to, who came in, he felt he had fallen from a height. And he used to say this prayer. He'd say, "Pop, I'm willing to do anything for a living. Keep me sober. But don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott." And because I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors, actors who I directed in soap operas. I'd come back to my home group with a new tale of humiliation every week, you know, and the guys would just be, "Oh!" I did this for about 3 years, and I had an overture made to me by a company named Ketchum Public Relations for this big comedy writing job. And you know what? It's different now. I've been sober a while. This will really help the guys I sponsor. It's really, really, really. Because they've seen me suffer, and now they'll see me prosper thusly. And it will be, whenever I use the word thusly about myself, I'm in really big trouble. And I had to do a videotape for these guys, which I did, and I went nuts. I mean, my brain blew up before I even found out about the job. I called my sponsor. I wrote a 10-step about it. I read it to Don, and I was cool. And a couple of weeks later, I get a call from Ketchum that I didn't get the job, and I had already surrendered it. And shortly after that, I got a call to go up to Lake Arrowhead in the mountains above L.A. to cater some commercials. So I go up there and I grab the call sheet, which is the sheet that gives you all the information about the shoot that you're doing. And I see that the shoot, the commercials, are for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I can't believe it. I look down at the end of the truck, and there's a guy videotaping me. And I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, we're taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. He's got this tape. He's going to go back to New York and show them the tape. And they're going to go, is that Scott Redman with the meatloaf? Oh, my God. I go back to the hotel. I call my sponsor, and I said, oh, we're getting a gift now. Oh, yeah. This is like being voted most attractive man on your cell block. This is great. This is great. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's a big, big, big miracle. And he said to me, he said, well, I guess God had enough writers and needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. As long as he's having a good time. I have a lot of problems. I'm 19 and a half years sober. I have a lot of problems. My life is no longer my circumstance, and I have a lot of problems. I know there are people in AA who don't have problems. I'm very happy for them. I've had problems. I have an eating disorder. I have problems with money. I have problems with my marriage sometimes. I have problems in business. And the people who I have been, if anyone puts their finger in your chest and says, that's AA, that's it, that's the tunnel, that's it, I stay away from those people. And what I mean by that is Alcoholics Anonymous, if you read our literature, was founded by seekers, by a bunch of niacin-eaten, acid-dropping, Ouija board-playing wackos, by incredible spiritual seekers. And those are the people that I've been hanging out with. You've heard about it all weekend long. You're hearing about structure, and you're hearing about seeking. You're hearing about structure and service, and if you do service, and service is the fuel for your life, you've got to be growing spiritually. If I'm not growing spiritually and I'm doing service, it becomes a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. A hollow enterprise. And I start hating the newcomers I'm working with. And I make fun of them more than listening to them. And listening is, for me, the breath of God. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. Some years ago, I was at a meeting, and I met this guy, and he called me when I got home, and he talked to me for an hour, and I said, uh-huh, four times, so he'd know I wasn't dead. And he explained to me that he had been stalking several women, he had a restraining order out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober now, and it's different. And at the end of the hour, he said to me, I feel so alone. And I said, what are you talking about? I hardly know you. I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting you. What do you mean you feel alone? And he said, well, I mean, I don't have a woman. And I said, what exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing? What are you bringing to the party? People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia aren't having dating problems. Alcoholics are. Some years ago, my wife was walking through our room, and she knew I was talking to a new guy, and she heard me saying to the phone, let's say the aliens are coming. So she stopped short. She ain't missing a word of this. I said, look, that's an outside interest. The aliens might be coming. I really don't know, but I have a question for you. Why you? Why are they coming for you? You're 11 days sober. You have no life. Why have they traversed a universe for your sorry ass? Why? Don't you think they'll call a cop, go to the post office, something? Why you? Plus, he's sleeping with the Bible on his chest to ward them off. So they're going to traverse the universe, walk into his room and go, oh no, the Bible, let's go home. So I'm at my home group and I'm telling this story, and the guy who the story was about walks into the room, and I'm watching the guy. And as I'm telling the story, the guy goes, ha 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 ha, uh-oh. At any rate, if you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. Welcome to AA. Welcome home. God bless you, and thanks for having me today.